you. Are you still working at the same facility that you and I were once working at? And if so, you've been there for quite a few years. And do you intend to stay there until retirement? Over to you, Jay.
Well, yes and yes. And they're actually making some of those critters that we're talking about there. So it's been an interesting segue.
So in other words, these robot devices, you're saying that you're involved with the manufacture of those robots? Is that what you're saying, Jay?
I was. Now I moved over to another group. But yes, they're actually testing them, and there's other companies that are doing it as well. They're more like cobots or co-workers, because they're assisting or doing tasks that other people could be doing, and then augmenting the workflow.
Since you've worked on these, you have a lot more knowledge than most of us. How does it detect a object on the floor? What is its method of collision avoidance, whatever? Is it doing it by radar, by light, by radio? What is the mechanism of it detecting and collision avoidance? Over to you, Jay.
It's a very complicated sensor suite. Includes LIDAR, includes barcode readers, includes cameras, you know, all sorts of detection. Many of them can learn a store just by letting them loose in the store, and they figure out what the aisles are, where they are, what's there, mapping the whole place. And as the other station said, you know, they go dock themselves when they need to recharge their batteries and so forth.
That sounds like a rather elaborate machine, Jay. Roughly how expensive is that device?
I guess it depends on how they're sold. But, you know, for some of the more mundane tasks, I'm sure that they cost less than the annual salary of a worker, but they end up generating work orders, you know, for the workers with hands who go around and do the tasks. You know, when you look at some of these retailers and they have a sale on, I don't know, Progressive Soup, if the shelves are empty, they're not selling any. If it's all in the back room, because there was a stock-out condition, they're not selling any. So they kind of look at the return on investment from making sure that the floor stock is available for everybody, and then doing things that have to do with planogram compliance. So if you've got Coca-Cola or a Pepsi paying to have premium space on an end cap, if you can take a picture of that, prove that it was done, then the payments go back to the stores that much quicker. Back to you, Dick, KA2UDZ.
You're sounding very good, Jay. I think you're operating mobile. Where are you right now, operating so well? Over to you, Jay.
Just passing exit 40 on the LIE.
Yeah, I'm hearing you very well on the input. That's how I knew. And a little bit of flutter when I listen on the input. Thank you for that information. Anybody with any further questions on any of the above, give me a call at us right now. KTRIW in the TechNet. Okay. When we do get to... I got a right piece of paper right here. When we do get to... the space report, we're going to be hearing about Blue Origin, the new Shepard launch and land device, which has made 11 launchings, if I understand correctly, and I think the very last one that was launched, it launched and landed, that one particular piece of hardware landed on the fifth or sixth time. Let me check with Paul, is that true? The last Blue Origin Shepard launch and land vehicle, I think that particular piece of hardware had landed for the fifth or sixth time, that much reuse. Is that true, Paul? WS2N, K2RIW?
Yeah,
Yes, that's right. You know, it comes with a booster, and it comes with a spacecraft that they're going to put people in it. Let's call it a capsule. But, you know, have gone up, and they have both been reused six different times. So, yeah, it was the sixth launch for NS-12, they call it New Shepard 12, along with the capsule. The capsule comes down with the parachute. So, yeah, and they've had previous New Shepards. Then they improve on them. And the next one coming off the factory floor is the one that they're going to use for people. So, sometime, I guess, next year. Hopefully, they get to that point. I mean, they've been at this forever. Back to you, Dick.
What company put that up?
Yeah, Paul, tell us who Blue Horizon is. Is that Elon Musk?
Oh, no, that's Jeff Bezos, the richest guy in the world. You know, Amazon.com. that guy. They're both into this. And he's the one also building the new Glenn. That's the one that built a massive factory down in Florida. And he plans on eventually getting that thing out. That's another rocket that's, of course, that's going to be orbital, but that'll be, comparable to, not quite as big, but getting close to the Saturn V height. Back to you, sir.
Okay, another exciting thing that happened this week is the Progress 74 launched from Russia to the ISS. On December 9th, it had 2.7 tons of payload on board, and it did automatic docking with the International Space Station. Wow. That was, I think that's Progress number 74. It automatically docked and brought up 2.7 tons of hardware, or consumables and whatever. And I think there's the Progress ship. I'm guessing there's two or three of those launches per year bringing stuff up to the space station. Is that true, Paul? WS2N, K2RIW?
Long time on a courtesy, Tony. Yeah, the Progress is usually three or four Progress per year. A lot of fuel for the ISS. But like, you know, you're right, they had cargo and oxygen and all of that stuff. Yeah, I think they did it probably three times this year. Other years they've done it four times.
As you can see, to maintain the consumables, oxygen, water, food, and hardware at the ISS, four of us. I guess an average of three or four astronauts are there most of the time. Sometimes as many as six, and sometimes as few as three, I think, on the ISS. To maintain that hardware 260 miles up takes a lot of launching, a lot of tons of stuff. You can imagine if you were trying to colonize Mars and you wanted to bring all the consumables they needed, how difficult that would be. 300 million miles away as opposed to 260 miles. So colonizing Mars, I think, is not going to happen in the next century, is my guess. To colonize, you have to be self-sustaining. You got to go there and be able to grow your own food. And grow your own food on Mars is extremely difficult. When you look at that movie called The Martian with Matt Damon, well, they made some really big errors there. There was one scene in the movie where he's growing potatoes in what looks like a greenhouse, and he's sealing off the greenhouse with a sheet of polyethylene plastic held on with duct tape around this round portal. No way in hell. Ordinary air pressure, 14.7 pounds per square inch, turns out to be 2,000 pounds per square foot. Simple piece of plastic like that is not going to maintain it. And the windows in the top of a greenhouse are not going to be able to take that kind of pressure. So, in order to grow food, you have to supply air pressure, because an awful lot of the carbon that makes up a tree doesn't come from the soil, it comes from the air. and how fast that carbon can come from the air into the tree, into its leaves, is a function of air pressure. So if you're growing plants on Mars, you've got to supply air pressure if you want the plants to grow at any reasonable rate. Sunlight and air pressure. And to allow that sunlight to get to your plants. And if you're doing it at 14.7 pounds per square inch, 2,000 pounds per square foot, boy, you've got to have an extremely strong structure. So, to have a colony that's self-sustaining, growing its own food on Mars, wow. You'd be amazed how difficult that is. When the Europeans came to the United States, let me drop them. When they came to the West, they knew when they got there, there's going to be sunlight, soil, air pressure, temperature, humidity, rain, a hell of a lot of things were given. All of that on Mars doesn't exist. Essentially no air, essentially no water, essentially no magnetic fields, no protection from cosmic rays, no way to grow plants, to grow food. So to simply send somebody to Mars and think they're going to be there, self-sustaining, and come back, I don't see it. Am I being overly pessimistic on this one, Paul? What do you think? WS2N, K2RIW.
It's going to be a long time before they could build a ceiling made of glass that's going to hold back that kind of pressure. You know, essentially 14.7 pounds per square inch, because they're going to want oxygen and nitrogen levels the same as what we have here on Earth, and they're going to probably want the same pressure as 14.7. And on Mars, it's on the outside, it's all right, it's not a vacuum, it's 0.1% of what we have here. So it's essentially almost a vacuum. So you're gonna have to have some really strong plexiglass panels that are built into the steel with good gas. So in the beginning, before they can develop that, I'm sure that it'll be all indoors. Maybe even buried on the ground, and to grow that food, the light, they'll use the light maybe from the sun into solar panels, and the solar panels will feed a million LEDs the right wavelength to grow your potatoes inside. That's the only way they're going to have to do it in the beginning. Back to you.
I agree with you, Paul. To make a greenhouse, you could never make it strong enough. You need an acre of property to grow enough food to sustain a man for a year. Rough numbers. So depending on how many colonists you've got going to Mars, you need some number of acres of plant growing. And does the soil have the right materials to do it? Is the soil, toxic? Does it have the right nutrients? You've established. The only way you can do it, as I see it, is you've got a metallic structure, which is where you're growing the food, that maintains the air pressure, and now you supply the light with light-emitting diodes, and the power to power them comes from solar cells on the outside, because to get enough sunlight through greenhouse-like panels that are strong enough, out of the question. So to be so self-sustaining on Mars, with ridiculously cold temperatures, I think it's 0.7% of the air pressure on Earth is what you got on Mars. Cold temperatures, almost no air, almost no water, almost no magnetic fields. No way. And it's 1,000 times further away than the moon. The Apollo program cost something like $31 billion in 1970 money. And you're going to send people 1,000 times further away. Now, every high school student is dreaming about the day when he sees an American astronaut standing on Mars. I'm convinced, for a whole bunch of reasons, that our grandchildren are not going to see that in their lifetime. Okay, I think we've finished the first section of the TechNet. I think we're about to go over to the second section, which is Dr. Roy, AC2GS, who's got a puzzle for us. And lots of other good information. So, Roy, AC2GS, go right ahead. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Thank you very much, Dick. This is AC2GS, and as always, I like to remind people of a few things. If you have any mailbag questions, technical questions for Dick, and you're not able to get onto the TechNet proper, or if you have anything that you would like to share with Paul, either something that you read or a topic you would like him to address, or if you would like to give me any topics or questions or cite references or dispute me, feel free, as long as you have references. The email address is mailbag@ac2gs.com. Again, my call sign, mailbag@alphacharlie2golfsierra.com. And as always, everything that I talk about pretty much will have links available on my link page, which is roy.ac2gs.com. Again, roy.ac2gs.com. And as always, we have a little chat room. You can get to the chat room by typing in chat.ac2gs.com. And we offer an audio feed for people who don't have radios or their Echo Link is acting up and such. And you just point your browser to technet.ac2gs.com. Let me drop for a second. One other thing that I want to remind people, next month, January, it's going to be Ham Radio University, and Andy is a regular at Ham Radio University. He does radio finding, you know, and he asked if I could join in and do some of it with him, and we were apparently successful. We got 1 hour to do it last time, and this time we're going to have 2 hours to do it. And I've written up a nice PowerPoint presentation that I promise people will not be boring. It'll be very informative, and it won't be boring. So please, if you're interested in Ham Radio University, it's January 4th, and me and Andy will be doing a little thing on how test equipment works. Now on with the show. Tonight, I thought I might start by recommending some interesting links that I found in this past week. There has been some discussion on the TechNet of the nano-VNA, so I posted a link to a new YouTube video showing the nano-VNA in action. It's already posted on the link page, roy.ac2gs.com, but please try and wait until after the TechNet is done before you take a look at it. Another YouTube that I heartily recommend is a video that discusses the classical nature of light refraction, you know, governed by Snell's law and Fermat's principle, in an interesting non-mathematical term, and just the simplification of a much more complicated quantum mechanical phenomenon taking place. And he does it without any math to frighten anyone. So if you have any free time, take a look at that as well. And now for our little puzzle. Almost everyone has seen or read of the magical immortality of the common Twinkie, these little pseudo-cakes that are so full of preservatives that some people think they may be able to be kept as an emergency ration should the end of the world occur for them. Well, like most well-known ideas, this is wrong as well. Twinkies actually have a bye-bye date, just like most other food products, and left to the vagaries of time, they will go bad just like almost every other kind of nutrition. But did you hear me say almost every other thing? Yep. So here comes the puzzle. Of all the kinds of types of nutritional food in our wonderful world, one, and pretty much to my knowledge only one, has demonstrated its near immortality as a reasonably healthy nutrient no matter its age, if properly sealed from the elements. And to the clever ones that will jump up and cry out table salt, well, yeah, that's not really a nutrient. It's a mineral necessary for life, but it has no calories. It's to offer a starving person. You wouldn't want to try and live on rock salt. So, I offer you tonight this puzzler. What is the most immortal of all nutrients that we know of, and how old is our oldest supply of it to show this amazing feat?
W2ASC.
Yes, W2ASC.
Okay, yes, that's hard tack.
Mm-hmm. It certainly is something that military has used as rations. It is durable. It doesn't spoil quickly, but given enough time, even hard tack will go bad on you.
V2GXO. 28.
Yes, Rich. I am going to say, honey. So clever little devil. How long do you think honey can stay?
So that's a hard guess for me, but I could say, for around 5 or 6 years.
Okay, so Rich sort of gave it away, and I let him give it away because I could have been kind of tricky with this. So it is honey, but I would be interested in other people's ideas of what is the oldest example of honey that has the same, pretty much within reason, nutrient value as it did when it was sealed up in its container. Rich offers about 5 years. Anyone with any other time range?
82 DWI.
Yes. What's your answer for this?
I heard that honey from the Egyptian era. So what's that? A little over 2,000 years in a sealed container was viable.
Okay, thank you very much. My problem is I'm dealing with far too clever people. Archaeologists have, in fact, found pots of preserved honey in Egyptian tombs that are thousands of years old. Sometimes the honey is crystallized over the millennia, but a little mild heating will return the honey to the original form and quality. Is it some pharaoh's blessing or a curse that has instilled this immortality to simple honey? Well, no, it's just chemistry and biology that performs this magical feat. You see, honey is primarily made of sugars, and sugar is something called hygroscopic. What's hygroscopic? Well, it means that it contains very little water, and it can absorb a lot of water from its surroundings. Any small organism desperate enough to attempt eating this honey or any hygroscopic material would have its own moisture sucked out of it by the honey and would crumple up like an empty tin can filled with a vacuum. That's why things like table sugar can sit in the same damn container year in and year out and still be decent. But table salt isn't nearly as immortal as honey, so something else is definitely going on. Honey is also extremely acidic. Honey has a pH in the range of about 3 to 4.5. At that pH, most bacteria tend to curl up and die. But that can't be the only reason for honey's unique condition. Molasses, which is made by a byproduct of cane sugar, is hygroscopic as well. It can be almost as acidic with a pH of 5.5. And although it can take a long time, eventually molasses can go bad like everything else. Let me drop for a sec. So, we've so far dealt mostly with chemistry. Now it's time to delve into biology as well. The answer, ultimately, for this question is the magic of bees themselves. Now, if you're squeamish and really like honey, you may not particularly care for the next bit of information. Bees take a flower's nectar, which is just some glorified sugary water, and they work their magic on it. They evaporate most of the water from it by flapping their wings to dry it out. And then comes the part that honey lovers might not like too much. Bees have an enzyme in their stomach called glucose oxidase. And when the bees regurgitate the nectar from their mouths into the honeycomb to make honey, this enzyme mixes with the nectar, breaking it down into two byproducts called gluconic acid and hydrogen peroxide. Now, hydrogen peroxide kills bacteria as well. So for this reason, honeys have been used for centuries for medicinal remedies. Because it's thick and rejects any kind of growth and contains hydrogen peroxide, it creates almost the perfect barrier against infection for wounds. The earliest recorded use of honey for medicinal purposes comes from the Sumerian clay tablets of thousands of years ago, which state that honey was used in 30% of their prescriptions. The ancient Egyptians used medicinal honey regularly, making ointments to treat skin and eye diseases. Honey was used to cover a wound or burn or a slash or something like that because nothing could grow on it, so it was a natural bandage. As long as you keep your jar of honey sealed away from moisture, it'll last a millennium or two. So the next time that you put honey on something, try to focus on its almost magical longevity and not that bee regurgitant is involved in its manufacture. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is KC2GS.
Now, storing honey for an emergency for food, yes, it stores for a long time. But now to how long can a person be sustained on honey? It's far from a balanced a diet as I see it, Paul. I mean, Roy. AC2GS, K2RIW.
I agree with you entirely, Dick. It is not a well-balanced diet. There is probably no thing that if you just eat it and nothing else will not lead to problems down the, as time goes on. It's just that it is a very quick, a safe way of storing calories. It's basically glorified sugar, and so sugar will at least maintain your energy stores. They lack in some of the minerals and vitamins and proteins and fats, and so I certainly wouldn't suggest anyone go on a honey diet. Probably not great for diabetics. But just as a food product, whereas most other things only last maybe 5 or 10 years at most. Some items can last longer than that, but they're under special conditions, like instant coffee has a very long shelf life if you keep it dry, because again, it's hygroscopic. It's dry, there's no moisture, so nothing can do anything to it. And if you store seeds, if you store grain in its original form, it can last for a very, very long time kept dry. Once you grind it in a mill and make flour out of it, you're lucky if you can get it to last for 6 months. But it's just, I thought it would be an interesting exploration into how long things can actually last. For the most part, I didn't know if anyone would know that honey can last thousands of years, which strikes me as an incredible thing for a food product.
It's a food product, but far from balanced. Meals ready to eat, I wonder how long they last, probably only a couple of years. So if you wanted to store food for a long period of time that will sustain life, if there's no other food available other than the stored food, as I see it, that's a much more complicated problem, Roy. What food, how balanced, how long it will last, and so on, how you store it. AC2GS, K2RIW.
I agree with you, Dick. There are military rations that people who are building bunkers today are investing in and storing. There are guys who are taking grains and beans and drying them. There are other people doing a lot of canning that they can. Its nutritional value tends to deteriorate no matter what you do about them. It's a good thing that we have a biostructure where all this stuff is turned over and recreated for us on a daily basis. You know, you're talking about Mars. It would be you couldn't store enough and have it last enough to make it viable. There's all kinds of problems. Military organizations spend a great deal of time worrying about these types of things for good reason. So the MRUs, you'll see them on YouTube regularly, the people taste test them. And they're kind of designed to last a relatively long time. They're not dainty things that expire in a couple of months. But whether they're as nutritional as the fresh stuff, probably not, but to any port in the storm.
We'd I'd like to believe the food in tin cans can be stored for a long time, but I think the answer is not very long. Most cans, metallic cans, contain a plastic coating on the inside separating the food from the can. At some number of months or years, the food eventually breaks down the plastic. The food starts reacting with the can. We have all seen very old cans of Coca-Cola or Pepsi-Cola that blow up, so to speak, because they eventually eat through the can. And I think an awful lot of other foods do. So I think there are very few foods in cans that would be safe after 5 years. OUFO, I mean the Roy, KTRIW.
I would agree with you again. In the old days before plastic was endemic, they would tinplate these things and get it to last a little bit longer. I don't think anyone in their right mind suggests that canned goods could go more than a couple of years generally. You might get lucky on one or two. But yeah, even the plastic, which is relatively, they pick plastic that tends to be inert. And as long as the food materials aren't extremely acidic, you know, again, there'll be degradation. It won't be as good as fresh food. But canned foods and dried foods is probably what most people who are getting ready for Kingdom Come are relying on as storage foods. They have bottles. There's some people like to bottle their foods, and you don't have that much degradation of the glass. It's rather inert.
If you were going to store food that you wanted to have reliable nutrition 5 or 10 years from now, what would you choose, Paul? I mean, Roy.
It would probably, and I really don't think in those terms. I was never one of those people who were interested in bomb shelters. I kind of unfortunately believe that if the fertilizer hits the fan, the best instruction is to bend over and kiss your backside goodbye. But I would probably diversify. I would do a little bit of everything. I would have military rations in one area of the bunker. I would have dry beans and grains and other things that can store dry and dehydrated. And then I would have bottled and canned products somewhere as well. So I wouldn't put all of my my pennies on one bet. Any other questions or comments on this topic, or I guess I'll move on to my stories.
KC2FYJ.
XMYJ.
I just have a general comment to remind everyone. The person who says it can't be done will never be the person who figures out how to do it. In 1960 or 61, when Kennedy said we're going to be on the moon in 10 years, I don't know.
I agree with you. If you're defeated, then you're not going to get anywhere. And the world needs dreamers, and that's why we have a lot of people dreaming about all kinds of engines and propulsion systems and projects to leave the solar system. But since I'm not in charge of any of that, I can tend to look dispassionately at the problem and realize that it's an incredibly big problem. Is it insurmountable? Over the long haul? Probably not. Over the short haul? My guess would be yes, it's insurmountable. It is just such an enormous engineering problem that as good our technology has grown in all these years, I don't think it's quite up to the need. There are so many problems to be addressed as far as Martian exploration. the least of which is the effects of radiation and zero gravity and weak astronauts when they land on Mars that then have to do Herculean things to keep themselves alive. But, over the long haul, maybe we'll discover all kinds of fun stuff like anti-gravity devices and such, and inertial dampening fields, stuff out of Star Trek and such. But I don't think so, not in my lifetime, but, I could be wrong.
Jason, when Kennedy made his pronouncement, which I think was around 1981, I'm going to send a man to the moon and return him safely to the Earth. At the time he made the pronouncement, it really was impossible with the resources available. A couple of years downrange, somebody invented the concept of lunar orbit rendezvous, by which only a small portion of the original launch spacecraft actually goes to the moon. Only a small portion of that comes back. Had that not been invented, the Saturn V rocket, as big as it was, with 6.5 million pounds of thrust or whatever, would have been 10-to-1 too small. And so it would have been out of the question if that breakthrough hadn't taken place. Had he made a pronouncement, I'm going to send a man to Mars, it would have been literally impossible with the resources he had at that time. So he hit it lucky on that one. A couple of other presidents have said, now that we've gone to the moon, we're going to go to Mars. And it hasn't happened. K2RIW.
2N.
Paul.
The U.S. 2N.
Go ahead, Paul. Paul, please.
Okay, I didn't want to double. Dick, look up the rocket Nova, N-O-V-A, someday. It was a proposed rocket that would have done just what you said, you know, without the system that Apollo used, you know, send the whole rocket to the moon and bring it back. You got to see the size of this proposed thing. Of course, they didn't go with it. You just bring up Nova or Wikipedia. Nova rocket Wikipedia, it's fascinating to read.
Was the Nova roughly 10 times bigger than the Saturn V, Paul?
I forgot. Yeah, something like that. So, I don't know. It was just enormous. It was a proposal originally by Braun, but of course he changed all of that.
Yeah, the guy who was pushing a lunar orbit rendezvous had a great deal of trouble selling it at first. It was an idea that was too radical at the time. But that Nova would have had to have been so big. I mean, like that movie in 1951, I think it was, Destination Moon, where you literally take a rocket, the whole darn rocket goes to the moon and comes back. You go through the mathematics of that, and a rocket big enough to do that would be so big that when you blast it off, you'd be changing the weather on the Earth. Over to you for any comments on that, Paul. WS2N, K2RIW, and turn it back to Roy.
Yes, very good. Yeah, in that movie, they were talking about 3.5 million pounds of thrust, and you know, they had no idea what they really needed to do. Although some of the things that they predicted actually was pretty good. So it's actually a good movie to watch. It's almost like a documentary form, but you know, done as a movie. 3.5 million pounds. Saturn V has 7.5 million, and you know, this Nova thing would have needed, I don't know, 20, 30 million. It's some bizarre number. Okay, Roy, over to you, WS2N.
Very good. Thanks, Paul. Thanks, Dick. And I often make this statement that unfortunately we kind of look back at those great days, and I loved the NASA back in those days and the Apollo missions and the missions that came before it, but you have to kind of look with a historical eye. If we didn't have our friends the Russians just annoying the heck out of us and the Cold War, chances are we wouldn't have put in the investment. I can still remember my adult people around me who kept on claiming that it changed the weather and it didn't help anyone who was starving anywhere, and why are we spending all this money? So for us technophiles, you know, it was a great joy. But to a lot of Americans, I'm sure at the time, there was a big question mark of why are we doing this? And one of the reasons that they gave that kind of stuck and work is because we want to beat those Ruskies. So we have to thank the Russians at least for something.
Yeah, fear is a great motivating force. During World War II, we were afraid of losing the war. We put forth huge effort. And during the Apollo, Mercury, Gemini, and Apollo series of NASA, we were afraid of being beat by the Russians. And so that fear made us do heroic things. Maybe there's not enough things to be fear now. Roy, go ahead.
I think there's probably just as many, if not more, things that we fear now. It's just that they can't be fixed by just showing your technological prowess. They've tried this with Martian missions before. Some people will, with a straight face, suggest that, you know, if we blow up or burn out the Earth, at least if we explore Mars, we have a secondary base of operations to escape to. But once again, if that's the only solution, I think it's time to bend over and kiss our backsides goodbye. Because if you think that the engineering feat required to plant the 3-4 guys or women on Mars is ridiculously high, think of moving a small city. Other questions, comments, statements, or what have you before I move on to the next story? Okay, those wacky Chinese genetic engineering scientists seem to be at it again. Not the same one that was found to be experimenting with little human babies. He's still somewhere under house arrest. No, these are other mad geneticists. A team of researchers created a pig primate creature by injecting monkey stem cells into fertilized pig embryos and then implanting them into surrogate sows, according to a piece by New Scientist. Two of the resulting piglets developed into interspecies animals known as chimeras, meaning that they contain DNA from two distinct individuals, in this case a pig and a monkey. Quote, this is the first report of full-term pig-monkey chimeras, co-author Tang Hai, a researcher at the State Key Laboratory of Stem Cell and Reproductive Biology at Peking, told New Scientist. Eventually, Hai and his colleagues aim to grow human organs in animals for use in transplant procedures. For now, the team plans to stick with monkey cells as developing animal-human chimeras presents a slew of ethical issues, the authors noted in a report published November 28th in the journal Protein and Cell. To create pig primate chimeras, Hay and his co-authors first grew cells from cynomolgus monkeys in a lab dish. The team then altered the cell's DNA by inserting instructions to build a fluorescent protein which caused the cells to glow bright green. These luminescent cells gave rise to equally radiant embryonic stem cells, which the researchers then could inject into prepared pig embryos. These glowing spots allowed the researchers to track the monkey cells as the embryo grew into the piglet. In a total of 4,000 embryos received a injection of monkey cells and were implanted in surrogate sows. The pigs bore 10 piglets as a result of the procedure, but only two of the offspring grew both pig and monkey cells. By scanning for spots of fluorescent green, the team found monkey cells scattered throughout multiple organs, including the heart, the liver, the spleen, the lungs, and skin. In each organ, between 1 in 1,000 or 1 in 10,000 cells turned out to be a monkey cell. In other words, the interspecies chimeras were more than 99% pig. Let me drop for a second. Oh. although low, the ratio of monkey to pig cells still outnumbers the maximum number of human cells ever grown in a human-animal chimera. In 2017, scientists created a human pig chimera that grew only one human cell for every 100,000 pig cells. The interspecies embryos were only allowed to develop for a month for ethical reasons, including the concern that human cells might grow in the chimera's brain and grant the animal human-like consciousness, according to New Scientist. Despite these ethical qualms, the same team of researchers went on to create human monkey chimeras earlier this year, according to a July issue from the Spanish newspaper El País. The results of the controversial experiment have not been reported, but scientists said that no human primate embryos were allowed to develop for more than a few weeks, the paper reported. Hay and his co-authors may have avoided the ethical issues involved with human-animal chimeras, but one expert wasn't impressed with their interspecies piglets. Stem cell biologist Paul Knopfler of the University of California, Davis, told New Scientist that the low ratio of monkey to pig cells seems fairly discouraging. Additionally, the two chimeras and all eight of the other piglets died shortly after being born, he noted. The exact reason for the piglet's death remains unclear. Hay told New Scientist, but he said that he suspected the deaths were linked to the in vitro fertilization procedure rather than the injection of the monkey DNA. Other scientists have found that IVF doesn't consistently work in pigs, according to a 2019 report in the Journal of Ferogenology. In the immediate future, Hay and his colleagues aim to increase the proportion of monkey cells to pig cells in future chimeras and eventually grow entire monkey organs in their pigs. Hay told the New Scientist in their paper, the authors note that their work in pigs could help pave the way towards the ultimate goal of human organ reconstruction in large animals. Now, how could anything like that get out of hand? Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS. Okay, on with the next, I guess. The Milky Way galaxy has its own magnetic field. It's extremely weak compared to the Earth, thousands of times weaker, in fact. But astronomers want to know more about it because of what it can tell us about star formation, cosmic rays, and a host of other astrophysical processes. A team of astronomers from Curtin University in Australia and the Commonwealth Scientific and Industrial Research Organization have been studying the Milky Way's magnetic field, and they've published the most comprehensive catalog of the measurements of the Milky Way's magnetic field in 3D. The paper is entitled Low-Frequency Faraday Rotation Measures Towards Pulsars Using LOFR, Probing the 3D Galactic Halo Magnetic Field, and it was published in monthly notices of the Royal Astronomical Society in April 2019. The team so far worked with LOFR or the Low Frequency Array, a European radio telescope. LOFR works in radio frequencies below 250 megahertz and consists of many antennas spread over about 1,500 kilometer area in Europe, with its core in the Netherlands. The team assembled the largest catalog to date of magnetic field strengths and directions towards pulsars. With that data in hand, they were able to estimate the Milky Way's decreasing field strength and distance from the plane of the galaxy, where the spiral arms are. In a press release, lead author Sobey said, "We used pulsars to efficiently probe the galaxy's magnetic field in 3D. Pulsars are distributed throughout the Milky Way, and the intervening material in the galaxy affects their radio wave emissions. Free electrons and the magnetic field in our galaxy between pulsars and us affect the radio waves emitted by the pulsars. Although these effects need to be corrected in order to study the pulsar's signal, they are really useful in providing information about our galaxy that would not be possible to obtain otherwise. As the pulsar's radio wave travels through the galaxy, they are subject to an effect called dispersion due to intervening free electrons. This means that the higher frequency radio waves arrive sooner than the lower frequency waves. Data from LOFR allows astronomers to measure this difference, called the dispersion measure, or DM. DM tells astronomers how many free electrons are in between us and the pulsar. If the DM is higher, that means either the pulsar is farther away or the interstellar medium is denser. Let me drop for a sec. That's just one of the factors in the measurements of the Milky Way magnetic field. The others involve electron density and the magnetic field of the interstellar medium. Pulsar emissions are often polarized, and when polarized light travels through a plasma with a magnetic field, the plane of rotation rotates. Dick has talked about this before. That's called the Faraday rotation, or the Faraday effect. Radio telescopes can measure that rotation, and it's called the Faraday rotation measure. According to Dr. Sobey, this tells us the number of free electrons and the strength of the magnetic field parallel to the line of sight, as well as the net direction. The larger the absolute RF means more electrons and or greater field strength due to larger distances or towards the plane of the galaxy. With that data in hand, the researchers then estimated the average magnetic field strength of the Milky Way towards each pulsar in their catalog. By dividing the rotation measure or the dispersion measure, that's how they did it. And that's how they created the map. Each single pulsar measurement is one point on that map. Obtaining these measurements for a large number of pulsars allowed them to reconstruct maps of the structure of the galactic electron density and the magnetic field in three dimensions. So what good does it do to have a map of the Milky Way's magnetic structure in 3D? The galaxy's magnetic field affects all kinds of astrophysical processes across different strengths and distance scales. The magnetic field shapes the path that cosmic rays follow. So when astronomers are studying a distant source of cosmic rays, like an active galactic nucleus, knowing the strength of the magnetic field can help them understand their object of study. The galaxy's magnetic field also plays a part in star formation, though the effect is not fully understood at this point. The strength of the magnetic field may affect molecular clouds. At smaller scales, magnetic fields play a role in star formation, with too weak or strong a field in a molecular cloud possibly inhibiting the collapse of a cloud into its stellar system. Let me drop for a second. This new catalog is based on observations of 137 pulsars in the northern sky. The authors say that their catalog improved the precision of existing rotation measurements on an average of a factor of 20. They also say that overall our initial low-frequency catalog provides valuable information about the 3D structure of the galactic magnetic field. But Dr. Sobey isn't finished mapping the Milky Way magnetic field strength yet. She's now using Australia's Murchison Wide Field Array to map the magnetic field in the southern sky. And both of these mapping endeavors are leading up to something even better. The world's largest radio telescope is now in the planning phase, called the Square Kilometer Array, and it will be built in both Australia and South Africa. Its receiving station will extend out to 3,000 kilometers or 1,900 miles from its central core. Its massive size and distance between receivers will give us our highest resolution images in all of astronomy. In the blog post, Dr. Sobey said, "My work in the future will focus on building towards doing science with the SKA telescope, which is currently entering the final stages of the planning phase. One long-term goal for SKA science is to revolutionize our organizing of the galaxy, including producing a detailed map of our galaxy structure. The Milky Way's magnetic field will have nowhere to hide." Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GX.
WB2GX.
Yes, Rich.
Don't magnetic fields also have a role in creating the planets, especially gas giants?
Yes, they do, but you have to also keep in mind that these are very, very weak magnetic fields. And apparently the astrophysicists aren't quite sure how these things mesh, but they're working on it. Any other questions or comments before I move on to the next story?
WS2N, did they figure out if there's a north or south, you know, how these lines are run?
Yes, they pretty much have. If you go to, I'll post the article, it has a graphic representation. You know, it's kind of flattened the three-dimensional aspects of the illustration, but yeah, it shows due north and due south. I don't know exactly what you could do with that information here on Earth, where those magnetic fields are swamped by our local ones. But yeah, like any other magnetic field, it has pole directions and such.
Okay, I wonder if it has anything to do with the electromagnetic wave, you know, as it's traveling through space, you know, maybe it's interacting with that. Who knows? But it's good to know that they've come up with that kind of an answer, and it's not going to stop there. They've come up with a newer, bigger antenna system that they're going to use. Back to you, Roy.
Yeah, well, who knows? I mean, that's the beauty of science. They detect these things, they write these things down. There's some graduate student who's going to look at that picture and put two and two together and come up with 22 and revolutionize something. So you don't know exactly what the future holds until you give time for people to kind of digest the information. You know, electromagnetic waves certainly do respond to magnetic fields. Whether they induce them is another question. But, you know, there's no reason to disbelieve that the galaxy doesn't have any kind of inherent magnetic field, just because we tend to think of it as a planetary manifestation.
Yeah, I think it's a good discovery. Very good.
Well, I agree with you, Paul. That's kind of why I presented it today. Anyone else have any comments or questions before I move on to the next story? Okay, most of the matter we see around us here on Earth, even our own bodies, has gone through at least one cycle of stellar birth and death, maybe more. So which type of stars did they come from? That's what a team of researchers at ETH Zurich wanted to know. The story of our solar system starts at about 4.5 billion years ago, when a stellar nursery, interstellar cloud, collapsed. At the center of that collapsed cloud, the sun came to life in a burst of fusion, and a disk of gas and dust formed around it. Eventually, all the planets in our solar system formed from that protoplanetary disk. Within that disk of material were grains of sand that had formed around certain other stars. These special grains were distributed unevenly through the disk like salt and pepper, according to Maria Schoenbachler, a professor at the Institute of Geochemistry and Petrology at ETH Zurich. As the planets of the solar system form, each one contains its own mixture of gas, dust, and those special grains. Advances in measuring techniques allowed scientists to detect the material that the planets were formed from and to determine its origin. It all comes down to isotopes. An isotope is an atom of a given element with the same number of protons in its nucleus, but a different number of neutrons. For example, there are different isotopes of carbon, like carbon-13 and carbon-14. While all carbon isotopes have 6 protons, carbon-13 has 7 neutrons, while carbon-14 has 8 neutrons. The measure of different isotopes in a planet, not just of carbon, but of other elements too, is like a fingerprint. And that fingerprint can tell scientists a lot about a body's origin. Star stuff has really extreme, unique fingerprints. And because it was spread unevenly through the protoplanetary disk, each planet and each asteroid got its own fingerprint when it was formed, Schoenbachler said in a press release. Over the years, scientists have been studying these fingerprints on Earth and in meteorites. Comparisons between the two reveal how long-dead red giant stars have contributed matter to the formation of Earth and everything on it, including us. scientists have been able to compare these isotopic anomalies between the Earth and meteorites for more and more elements. Sean Bachler and the other scientists behind the new study have been examining meteorites that were part of the core of asteroids destroyed long ago. They focus on the element palladium. Let me drop for a second. Previous studies and other scientists have examined isotope ratios for other